The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Long standing. My feet are really tired.
Indeed.
That's right, because I joined the ISO. The ISO was formed in the spring of 1977, and I joined it in August of 1977 in New York City, where there was one other ISO member. His name was Peter Court. He was a British graphics art student at Pratt Institute, and he was the one who designed the fist that everybody loves, the ISO fist. So let's hear it for Peter. We used to joke, you know, you take Queens, I'll take Manhattan. So, you know, Leonard Cohen didn't think of the idea first. And of course today in New York City, I don't know exactly what the membership is, but it's certainly substantially higher than two people. But the reason I start that way is because, of course, you can't really do much with two people. But you can't do that much with 150 or 250 people. You can certainly do way more with that many people than you can with two. But you also have to have a sense of proportion and perspective, because as people who've been in this conference throughout the weekend have heard probably at least some people say, socialism is the self-emancipation of the working class. It's the act of the immense majority in the interest of the immense majority that springs all the superincumbent strata into the air and erects a society anew. It's based on mass struggle involving millions of people. It cannot be achieved in any other way. It's important to keep that in mind, that goal in mind, because we're not adherents of the old reform social democratic idea that the movement is everything and the final goal is nothing. But we're also not of the political tradition which says the final goal is everything and we should just sit around with our arms folded and wait for it to happen because the movement isn't good enough yet. But we need to keep in mind that goal as well, because if we're talking about a movement that will involve tens of thousands, then hundreds of thousands, and then millions of people in active resistance to capitalism to overcome it, then we remain relatively tiny and inconsequential. And that's really important to understand, not to feel bad about it, but to understand the enormity of the tasks involved and the importance of what it is that we're doing, without falling into a situation in which we engage in chest beating or bragging. And in fact, one of the things I want to do in this talk is brag not about our successes, but about our mistakes. And what I mean by that is not, it was so great that we did that wrong, but to emphasize the importance of acknowledging and understanding, based on experience and what you've decided to do previously, what you've done wrong in order to do something better or to change course when necessary. Because the history of the left in the world is riddled with, you know, the detritus, you know, probably still floating around and banging into the, you know, satellites out in space, of people who thought they knew what they were doing and developed a perspective about who they were and what they could do in the world, what that was wildly out of relationship to what was possible, and then broke apart on that basis. And so the question of perspective is extremely important. I sometimes, when I give talks like this, I like to quote an American Trotskyist named James Cannon. Maybe I'll just paraphrase him. He said, it's really important to have good politics. You can't move forward in the world unless you have a sharp political understanding of the world, how to change it, what forces can change it, the nature of capitalism, how to overcome it. But you also have to know what to do next. And if you don't know what to do next, but your politics are great, you will founder. If your politics aren't that great, let's just hope you don't know what to do next. But that's a separate question. So, you know, when the ISO formed, it was in the late 1970s, as I said, and since the ISO has been in existence, we have lived through neoliberal reaction. We have lived through what was originally called the employer's offensive in the United States, which was more than just an economic offensive, but was an ideological offensive tied to it to roll back all of the gains, economic, social, political gains of the 1960s and 70s. That's when the ISO formed. We're in a very different period today, so I don't want to just say the ISO was started with, you know, 80 people. I don't know what the exact number was, but it started with about 75 or 80 people. And today the ISO has hundreds of members, maybe not, you know, maybe around 1,000. I'm not sure the exact membership of the ISO, but it's a much larger organization. And I don't want to just say what I said at the beginning, which is that that's of course very important. The difference between having 2 and having 200 is very different. But I also want to say that the political conditions, I think, if people probably are aware of, are very different today as well, and not different. And there are two ways. One is millions of people today embrace in some vague way the idea that socialism is better than capitalism. That was not true in the 1980s. In the formative period of the ISO, millions of people did not embrace the idea that socialism was better than capitalism. Get your head around that, because you live, for the young people here who've radicalized, this is a very, very different world. When we were trying to build the ISO, I joined the ISO when I was 18. Summer of Sam, I arrived in New York City right after the blackout and right after, you know, Reggie Jackson, and so on. And disco. Ooh, I feel love, I feel love, I feel love, I feel love. Anyway, so, but there's, in other words, we're trying to build an organization, a socialist organization, in the middle of a period of growing reaction. One that we could not have foreseen would involve decades of attacks on the labor movement, a systematic weakening of the labor movement, and a massive decline in strikes and of resistance, of organized resistance on the part of the working class as part of this neoliberal reaction. To the point where, and I'll just say this before I go on, is that we live in a very peculiar time where there's a deep radicalization on one level, or maybe not as deep as we'd like it to be, but certainly a very substantial, widespread sense that the system is wrong. There's something wrong with the system that's linked to the economic crisis, that's linked to the Occupy movement, Black Lives Matter, the collapse ideologically of neoliberalism, all of the attacks on people's lives. We have a peculiar situation where there's a massive radicalization in the sense that people are quite dissatisfied, and millions of young people want a better world. I mean, there's no question, all the polls show it, but yet I'm citing a poll. You know, I'm not going to cite the exact poll, but people know the polls that we've been publishing. You know, we still live in a society where, to understand the level of radicalization, you still have to cite polls, because we still don't have sustained mass struggle. We have had mass struggles, but they're very episodic, but we don't have sustained struggle as we had in the 60s or in the 1930s. Of course, they had their ups and downs then, but you had hundreds of thousands and then millions of people engaging in mass struggle, and out of it, producing layers of radicals who wanted to fundamentally transform the world in one way or another, to the point where by the end of the radicalization process you had, you know, another poll, hundreds of thousands of students saying we need a revolution in the United States, that you had, you know, one third of like all black soldiers saying in Vietnam saying, when I get back I'm going to join the Black Panther Party. That kind of radicalization. We don't have that kind of radicalization right now, because we have that peculiar combination of that mass radicalization I described in terms of people's ideas, sometimes expressed in episodic struggle, combined with an extremely weak labor movement that's under attack, that has a low level of struggle, low level of strikes, and that is the contradiction that we face and creates potential for enormous excitement and enormous frustration at the same time. And I'll come back to that because that makes the question of perspective extremely important. Knowing what to do next and being able to evaluate extremely important. It's the politics and history of the ISO. I am going to do neither. That's impossible. But what I will do is say something about politics and a little bit about the history as a way of illustrating some of the political points I want to make. I'll just preface it, though, by saying that one of the things that I want to do, and I know Bill Roberts, who is was in the IS, the precursor group to the ISO, and was also been in the ISO since its beginning. And there's other people in the room who were in the ISO, in the IS, and the ISO as well. We want to scan. I believe that there should be some kind of database archive that ISO members and others can access, which historically, maybe it'll end up in the Marxist Internet Archive. I don't know, but that goes back through the IS, documents of the IS, the ISO. Its internal documents, its debates, its warts, its blemishes, its good hairdos, good hair days, whatever. Its strengths, its weaknesses. People need, because that's how you learn. The things that we've done that we're proud of, the National Network of Campuses Against the War. I think I got in trouble when I told people that was started by us. But I can say that now without getting in trouble. The ISO started the National Network of Campuses Against the War in 1990, which only had a brief existence because the attack on Iraq only had a brief existence, but was a successful effort at building a student movement against the war that involved thousands of students in the United States, that we were centrally involved in forming, leading, shaping in a completely non-sectarian but highly political way. That's just one example of something that I'm quite proud of that we've done, and I'll give some examples of that, but I also want to give, as I said, examples of our failures and then how we reacted to them. But first, politics. Politics is key. Our tradition. Our tradition goes back to Karl Marx. The self-emancipation of the working class is the act of the working class. Therefore, against any form of substitution, any idea that some small group of people can substitute themselves, or a state can substitute itself for the mass activity of millions of people to transform society, that is absolutely central. The centrality of fighting oppression. You cannot have the unity of the class in struggle against capitalism unless all forms of oppression are challenged. Not after the revolution, not after we've dealt with this issue, but as we struggle and as we move forward, the question of exploitation and the question of oppression have to be linked constantly, and the battles have to be fought, and the job of a socialist, to paraphrase Lenin, is to be the tribune of the oppressed. Absolute independence from the Democratic Party. Independent organization of the working class so that its politics and its struggle is not diluted by people who stand in an alien class position and at every step of the way will attempt either by force or subterfuge or lying or deceit to derail that process. No support for actually existing socialism, which made a travesty of the idea of socialism and was based on bureaucratic class rule from Soviet Union to Eastern Europe, China, and beyond, which is not as relevant a question today because a lot of those states don't exist, but as we know from the debates around Syria, remain absolutely central political questions because the idea of socialism from above still contends and still is a force against the idea of the self-emancipation of the working class and the oppressed, warps and distorts and destroys and damages our struggle. Revolutionaries, these are just different points. That's part of our tradition. Revolutionaries must be organized in some way, no matter the period or state of the class struggle. A revolutionary party cannot be built in the heat of mass struggle. The process, the task of building it has to begin in some form, no matter what the state of the class struggle is. And then a final point, consciousness is not static. It shifts as a result of capitalism's own contradictions in the state of the class struggle. It is struggle that teaches and radicalizes, and therefore revolutionary organizations can vary in size in periods of low struggle, sometimes are quite small and have to uphold the banner of socialist politics without any immediate expectation of mass struggle or growth, and periods of mass struggle where tens of thousands and then hundreds of thousands of people become open because of their own experiences of struggle to revolutionary ideas. We have not experienced that on a scale that we would fully understand, but all of us have been in situations where we've seen people radicalized by struggle. Now try to imagine that on a scale involving hundreds of thousands of people. You get an idea. Damn it, I'm already running out of time. Okay, so those are some of the key points. That comes out of the tradition of Marx, of Lenin, of the Bolshevik Revolution, of Trotsky, of the IS, the International Socialists that came out of the Trotskyist movement that broke from it because it said Russia's a new class society. This is that we have to uphold the idea of self-emancipation, of socialism from below. So that's the politics. Politics matter. And perspectives also matters. And that's why I wanted to paraphrase James Buchanan. He said, you need politics, but if you don't know what to do next, you will founder, as I said. And that's really important. And it doesn't mean that what you decide to do next is right. But you have to make a stab at it, because you can't act in the world unless you've made an evaluation of the current state of balance of class forces and what to do next, and then decide what you're going to do on that basis. And it's only on that basis that you then make mistakes and adjust and figure out the right thing to do, or do the right thing and do maybe something else wrong. But the point is, if you're not making mistakes, you're not doing anything. And you have to do something to have success, to put it quite basically. And just to give you an example, I'm going to read from some past perspectives documents. In 2009, Obama takes office, and we have a convention in which we essentially say, it's speculative, and we're not saying this is absolutely going to happen, but we say, given the level of hope that Obama inspires, given the level of hatred that his election represents towards the existing order, and given that people expect Obama to deliver on all kinds of things, large majorities expected Obama to deliver on health care, immigration, down the line, you name it. People expect women, all kinds of questions. It was like, he's going to make the world a better place for ordinary people in the United States. That's why people voted for him. And they came out in the millions. I mean, I don't know if people saw the inauguration protests. Celebrations, I mean, yeah. Not protests. Which were a little bit smaller than Trump's inauguration, but not that much. No, and so we said, well, this could be an FDR moment. Because of the economic crisis, the ruling class has to use state intervention in some way to kind of restore stability. But this could lead to a heightened level of struggle and expectation, which will then put pressure on Obama to shift from neoliberal policies towards, at least in some way, more FDR type, I have to implement certain social reforms in order to save capitalism. That was kind of what we argued. And then within the year, the next year at the convention, we wrote a document which said, what did we get right and wrong in the ISO's 2009 perspective, is one of the subheadings. And it says, well, we were right about the scale of the economic crisis. We were right about the class character of the Obama administration, that he was going to be tasked with restoring the legitimacy of American imperialism and of the economy. We were right about that there would be a significant rise in radicalization. That was expressed in a number of ways, which we could talk about. But we totally got wrong that there was going to be a rise in struggle, and because of that, the corollary of that, that Obama would be pressured to have an FDR moment, did not happen. And so we wrote, Obama's first year in office, in hindsight, closely resembled Clinton-era centrism. Indeed, the centerpiece of Obama's recent State of the Union address was to lower the deficit by freezing federal spending, taken directly from the Republican Party playbook. That's one example. And then this is from a 1989 document assessing some of the things that the ISO got wrong in its early days. I think it was written by Ahmed. It was a perspective document written in 90. The ISO had about 80 members when it formed. It grew to about 120 members under right-wing Reagan era, maybe by 1983, and then moved into a kind of crisis. And just as a preface to this, understand that the ISO was part of a group before it formed called the Left Faction in the International Socialists. It was an organization, and I don't have time to go into it, that essentially said that, and this again comes back to the question of perspective, that the IS had a triumphalist, completely overblown perspective about what was possible. In the mid-70s, the IS said all of our members should industrialize because the economic crisis has hit, the working class is going to move, and we need to develop a revolutionary leadership in the class, and so we need to move all of our members into key sectors of industry and do mass work, mass agitational work, out of which we recruit a layer of workers, and we will become, within a few years, a workers' combat organization. And the Left Faction said, that's not going to happen, that's unrealistic, and they had a whole number of other arguments. But again, the question of perspective. The most damaging perspective is the this is it perspective when it's not it. And the most difficult one for socialists, because we're always on the lookout for this is it. Even if it's a little this is it. Wisconsin. What Wisconsin was it? Wisconsin was incredible. People occupying the state capitol. The ISO was centrally involved in that. The Democratic Party killed it, and so it didn't. It didn't go anywhere. In fact, it was an isolated event in a certain sense. But as revolutionaries, we want to go to every one of those events and go, how do we extend it? How do we make it more than what it is? How do we use it as a launching pad to have a Michigan or a Wisconsin? I mean, or a Wisconsin, or an Indiana, or a California? You have to do that because you have to be able to take every opportunity and push it as far as you can. But within that, there's always the danger of overestimating what it is that you're capable of doing and exaggerating what's possible. That's why the question of assessing afterwards is always important. We were wrong. We thought it could be this. We tried to make it this. We weren't completely wrong, because you have to be a little bit wrong to be right if you're going to push. But then you have to say, well, okay, we were wrong. We have to pull back. We have to reassess. The IS didn't do that. They expelled the Left Faction, and the Left Faction became the ISO, realized if we're going to survive, we have to immediately put out a newspaper, and the only way, and we have to develop a more realistic perspective. But I just want to read, the realistic perspective was no industrialization, go after anything that moves, and be realistic. The class struggle is not as strong as we like to be. It's quite scattered, and we have to just go wherever there's a strike, where student radicalism, wherever there is, we need to be there. We need to have a newspaper. We need to sell it. We need to raise the red flag. But we need to be the friendly group, the open group, and a group that doesn't engage as not just the IS did, but the whole Maoist tradition, which is even worse, chest beating about being the vanguard and being the group that's going to be it. And so on that basis, we grew modestly, and then in 1983 had a crisis. And this is Ahmed trying to assess that crisis. In which we kicked out our leadership and replaced them, which I don't intend to go into. We drew several important lessons which are worth underlining today. First, our policy of go after anything that moves worked well in our first 2 years because there was still a relatively large number of issues one could be involved in, and the group easily gravitated to those that were most promising. As activity tapered off, remember, this is going into the Reagan era, the struggles are collapsing, and the labor movement is under immense, unprecedented attack. As activity tapered off, we found ourselves either attempting to create that activity ourselves, substitutionism, or continuing our involvement in a movement which was really no more than ourselves and a handful of other leftists. It became a matter of moral duty to be involved in various activities rather than an involvement based on a political assessment or perspective. Having rejected priorities in industry, we rejected any prioritization of our work. Today, this is still a problem. Our problems were compounded by the lack of political clarity and argument in the organization, which we merrily ascribed to being the friendly group. We never, for example, assessed our involvement in the anti-nuclear movement. In retrospect, one of the problems with our involvement was clearly that in identifying ourselves as militants in the movement, we involved ourselves in a number of direct actions, especially at Seabrook, I was there, power plant, which did little to build the organization. Moreover, our arguments against a reliance on elected officials, pacifism, and so forth, while correct, were not addressed to the much larger group of activists involved in the anti-nuclear movement. Instead, we addressed the largely already converted anarchist types. So we oriented on the wrong audience. This is just a slice of examples to give people to understand how the ISO has attempted to approach the question of politics and what we do next. What we do next has to be connected to how we evaluate what we decided to do next. Because otherwise, your memory is quite short, and you end up blithely going forward from one thing to the next without actually learning from what you've done. Because the only way you can learn is by making mistakes and then evaluating the mistakes you made. If you only had successes, there would be nothing to learn. And in fact, if we only had successes, there'd be no class struggle. As the IWW used to say, the working class would just spit and the ruling class would drown. I mean, there'd be no need for an art of politics if there wasn't contradictory consciousness, if there weren't sides contending with each other, that you had to battle out, that ups and downs and struggle, and, you know, half the people accepting the system and the other half rejecting it and then fighting. Unless you had those contradictions, none of these things would even matter. So politics in that sense is an art. But I think there are certain basic things about the ISO's politics that we've carried with us throughout. And in this, I want to quote a document, from a perspectives document from 1978, some months after the ISO formed. Just a few of the quotes, if you'll bear with me. The first step, he's saying, how do we achieve this goal? And the goal he describes, he really goes back to Duncan Hallis. People should read this essay, if they haven't, Towards a Revolutionary Socialist Party by Duncan Hallis, where he says, the last 40 years, unfortunately he's writing this in the early 70s, the last 40 years has essentially separated and rooted socialism out of the labor movement, socialist politics. In the United States, more than any other place, the task of socialists is to reconnect those two things. And that's not going to be an easy task. And this is what this perspectives document says. The first step should be, must be, an honest, realistic appraisal of the circumstances and of the present balance of forces. And of course, that's constantly changing. But that, for socialists, has to be a starting point for what, always for what should we do next. We can in no way ignore or minimize the reality, which he goes through at the time that he's writing in 1978, which is the class struggle is fragmented, there's an attack that's developing on the working class, socialists are very isolated from the labor movement then, there are not very many workers that are either interested or even aware or conscious of socialism as a set of political ideas, and we can't ignore that reality. And he says, we in the ISO represent at best a theoretical trend, international socialism. Our challenge, our first step is to develop that trend and to embody it in a living, active organization. That was important, and it's still important, because there was a whole layer of people in the IS and in the Maoist movement who concluded from this period, the end of the 60s, they said, we need to overthrow capitalism. We can't just keep fighting imperialism. We can't just keep fighting these battles. We need to overthrow it. So we need a revolutionary party. And so they went through this period of party building, and they said, party building is a waste of time. You have to adapt to what exists. You know, put on the American flag on your jacket. Be a good militant in the union. Support the Democratic Party. And there was a drift to the right and a rejection of party building. And so we didn't react to that by saying, no, let's build parties like little sects like they did in the 70s that pretended to be the vanguard but weren't. But let's not abandon the idea that you need organizations of revolutionaries to get to a point where you can build such a party. That is, it's not going to just arise because there's high levels of struggle. There have to be cadres of militants who have been active in the world, learning from struggles, having in some modest way taught someone something as well from their own experiences in activism and leadership, and out of that help to develop or be part of the constituent elements of a future revolutionary party in the United States. So there was a certain seriousness about the project combined with modesty about it, which I believe we have had throughout and which we still need to have. And then he says, the second part of the challenge is more difficult. And unfortunately, I'm out of time. The second part is more difficult. Why an organization, or at least why now? And this is what I said. The need for a revolutionary party has been obvious for some time, but why should a small group like the ISL imagine that it will be any more successful than any of the others? The answer is quite simple. We do not believe that there is any evidence that revolutionary forces, forces capable of carrying through a revolution successfully, will develop spontaneously on the day of the barricades. On a more mundane level, we believe that Marxism makes no sense outside of the struggle to apply it, to test it against reality, to attempt to make it part of a living movement. Without in any way revising old works and writing new ones, we believe that Marxism must always have a connection to the actual struggles of the day, must always have a connection, with the working class militants and socialist activists of the day. Moreover, we believe that there are practical as well as theoretical contributions that could be made today. And that's kind of the argument that he makes. And then he says, we are not the vanguard. I don't have time to quote it all. But we need to be understand ourselves as part of the constituent elements of a future revolutionary party in the United States. I still believe that that's our perspective. And I had a lot more stuff I wanted to say, but I wanted to say a few things about some of the work that we did in the ISO. First of all, the period... We've gone through different periods. I said that overlaid on top of it has been something we did not expect, which has been a sustained attack on the working class without a one-sided class war, let's say. And we had no idea it was going to last this long. At the same time, periods of sharp radicalization, as I said, but that are quite episodic, but are reflected not only in consciousness, but in episodic upsurges in struggle. The anti-war movement, great. Gulf War in 1990, I said, where we started NNCA. In the early 90s, the Rodney King Rebellion showed that the depths of anger and bitterness and rage against racism, systematic racism in the United States, and the collapse of the Soviet Union, which led us to believe in the 90s that to have a little bit of a one-dimensional understanding of what those changes meant. On the one hand, I think we correctly understood that a certain era had ended. In a certain sense, the Reagan era had ended, even though neoliberalism was continuing, and that there was signs of radicalization. And the ISO grew through our activity in the anti-war movement. I think at the end of the 1980s, the ISO only had about 150 members, maybe less. And no? Something like that, and then as a result of the anti-war movement in the early 90s, we doubled, and then in the mid 90s, we doubled in size again. So clearly, there was something happening. There was a shift in consciousness that was going on in that period that was reflected in a number of things. Also, the labor wars that were happening in Central Illinois, our work around the Klan, things I don't have time to go into. People really need to listen to Leonard Klein's talk on. Midwest Network to Stop the Klan, absolutely brilliant. I'll give you an anecdote of how clearly things had changed with the collapse of the Soviet Union in this new political period. We went down to Central Illinois where there was a lockout of Staley workers we were heavily involved in, Caterpillar strike. We went down on a regular basis. We organized strike support. We were very involved in that. In fact, throughout the ISO's history, we were always extremely serious about relating to important strikes. But we went down there, and Ahmed can tell you this. I mean, when he went down to try to talk to miners in the late 70s, and this happened to me too, occasionally you'd show up at a picket line and at least one worker would be so exercised over the fact that you were communists that the other workers would say, you're gonna have to leave the picket line. Because, you know, Bob's on strike with us and Bob's angry and we can't have a picket line that's being disrupted, so you have to leave. So here we're showing up with socialists. Now, every other time we'd show up with socialist work and people go, yeah, great, socialists, you support us. But every other time we got, get the fuck out of here, okay? Nobody has that experience now. I mean, that just does not happen. But then in the mid-90s, we go down to, Eric Ruder and I go down to interview Caterpillar workers, and we're sitting in the union office, and these guys are all Vietnam vets. And these guys are factory workers. They're in their 40s, 50s, 60s. They were in Vietnam. They love America. They love the flag. I mean, they're middle, you know, they're in central Illinois, right? I mean, we go down there, and this worker says, "Now, wait a minute. I got to ask you a question," because for some reason, no matter what rural part of the United States you're in, you have a little bit of a drawl. Now, are you guys communists? Because I've been fighting communism all my life. That's how the meeting starts. The interview starts. So I said, "No, we're socialists. We think that workers should run society, not the bosses." And he goes, "Oh, okay." And the same thing happened when we went down to the miner strike in the early 90s. We go down to this miner strike. There's this big picnic, big parade. I go up to a regional mine organizer, and I say, "Can I interview you for socialist work?" He goes, "Sure, come on over." We go sit down. He goes, "Socialists and communists built this union." I'm like, something's different here. those were signs. But we exaggerated what was possible. You know, and we had to reassess, because we thought we can instantly recruit people. People are being radicalized, and when people are being radicalized, they can become socialists more quickly, and we can recruit them more quickly. Well, that's true, but guess what? If they're not being radicalized enough, if the level of struggle isn't as far as you think it is, and the level of shift in consciousness isn't what you think it is, you end up with what we used to call the revolving door. Join the ISO, sign a card, see you later. Revolving door, you know, they're not real members. So that would happen a lot, thanks. And and this was when we began to develop a criticism of the methods of the IS, the Socialist Workers' Party in Britain, that we were connected to this international socialist tendency, because they had an exaggerated perspective in which they said, what passed for communism has collapsed. State capitalism has collapsed in Russia. This means that there is a massive opening for the rebuilding of a revolutionary left on genuine politics of self-emancipation and international socialism. Therefore, and the second part of that was, economic crisis is coming. The permanent arms economy, which sustained the post-war boom, is over, and there will be deep-seated, intractable economic crisis, which will produce polarization and the massive growth of the left and a new opportunity for us. That's not what happened. There was polarization. The far right began to grow in that period. There were elements of truth to all those things. In the long term, it's absolutely true that the collapse of the Soviet Union has taken off the table the dead weight, or in a certain sense, the dead weight of Stalinism, and it's opened up the possibility for politics like ours in a way that had never existed before. But it wasn't an immediate process. In fact, the immediate result of that was the collapse of the left, which we're still facing. And that's another aspect of the contradiction we face. Because of the ideological crisis of neoliberalism, because of the disgust at the various aspects of capitalism, things like Grenfell just reinforce and explode in people's consciousness, combined with quite low levels of class struggle, you have a completely strange combination. And at the same time, a left which hasn't been able to adequately respond to what is, on the surface, one of the most ideal conditions for the growth of the left in years. Now that's begun to shift. The Bernie Sanders thing showed that radicalization can find a voice, and people are actually now looking for organization in a way that didn't happen before. But that's what we've been working with. I'm going to have to wrap up. That is when, you know, we began to distance ourselves, and eventually, I won't go into it, we're expelled by the international socialist tendency. But we said, this is an unrealistic perspective. And they said it was the 1930s in slow motion. It will unfold more slowly, but it's going to be just like the 1930s. And we said, number one, there is no deep intractable crisis right now. In fact, there's a boom. In the 90s, in the late 90s, there was a boom, mid to late 90s. Number two, the left is weaker now than it was. And number three, the collapse of the Soviet Union has not produced this level of radicalization and polarization that you expected. And in fact, you know, Tony Blair, how long was Tony Blair in power? I mean, he was in power for a really long time, which they expected not to happen. But they never reassessed it. And in fact, and this is really how an organization comes to grief. If you say, this is it, and this are the reasons why it's it, and you then close the blinds and say, everybody get out there, because this is it, and then you forget to get feedback, and people come back and tell you, well, it doesn't seem like it's it, because this is our experience, and you look at the world and say, that seem like that's what the world is showing us. And your response is, no, this is it. You're wrong. Get out there. You're just not trying hard enough. The immediate impact of that is to completely depoliticize your organization. It will happen overnight. Overnight. Your cadre will not be cadre. They will become fools. Because they're running around on an idea which has no connection to reality. And the deeper the gap between what you're saying about the world and the world depoliticizes you more quickly than anything else. And that's the death of any political, and it's always the danger. The two dangers of any organization is that you adapt to what exists, right? The movement is everything, the final goal is nothing, or you exaggerate the possibility and attempt to impose a reality on the world that doesn't exist, and you break your organization by doing it, and then you flip the other way. You say, well, we tried to do that and it didn't work, so let's adapt instead. So they're actually quite connected. And so that's why the question of building a socialist organization is a dialectical process. It's a process of continual reevaluation. The ISO is by no means a perfect organization. We have had unedifying debates, nasty personalistic disputes, because we are stamped by the world we live in. Socialism, unfortunately, will not be created by people who have grown up in a society that knows no class division, oppression, sexism, and so on. And so what we're doing, we should be extremely proud of. Because as socialists, many radicals, when they become radical, believe that the way to maintain your radicalness is to live in a bubble. In fact, in the Black Lives Matter movement, there were a lot of people like that. We need to live in a bubble, and fuck you if you don't get the world I'm in. And that's in some of the people that were involved in Occupy as well. Once you figure out that the world is a fucked up place and you have to resist it, there's a pressure or a possibility that you will say, I get it and you don't. Why do I have to explain it to you? Even though 2 weeks ago someone did have to explain it to you. You've now decided that, you know, you're going to live in this bubble. Well, the art of being a revolutionary is that you have to be in an organization which nurtures and supports each other, compares notes, and learns, but has to have a connection to reality. To go back to the quote from the 1978 document, you have to have a connection with reality. And having a connection with reality is dangerous, because it will impurify you. You know what I mean? What we're doing is meaningless unless we have a relationship to the world. But having a real relationship to the world carried out by imperfect people creates all kinds of conflicts, issues, problems, and we have to argue them out, reassess, stop what we're doing, look back, move forward, take a leap, pull back again, reassess. That's the art of politics. But the art of politics is meaningless unless you actually have politics that deserve the art. And that's why you always have to come back to the self-emancipation of the working class, the tribune of the oppressed, and all those politics that I outlined at the beginning. If you put those two things together the right way, you can go somewhere.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.